the question I've heard many committee members ask when it's been proposed that a CEO has activity-based goals, the response often is, isn't that your job?
Right.
Aren't you just describing your job?
But I think the question that the committee needs to ask is that part of your job, or is that something we're incentivizing and it's worth shareholders paying the incremental dollar for outperformance on those measures? What would make you jump up and down? What performance would everybody in the room just say, home run?
Right.
And what level of performance would you say unacceptable?
When is the plan broken?
I mean, that's a good indicator. It could be broken.
Yeah.
If it's never paying out, testing those that historical payouts versus performance, obviously, looking at investor expectations, looking at peer performance and payouts, all of those things, I think, again, should be tested regularly.
Welcome back. Darren, Ryan, excited to be here again. Today, we're going to explore one of the risks in compensation program design, which is when the plans start feeling more like activity-based and measuring activities rather than true outcomes. So, Darren, maybe I'll start with you. Give me some examples of an activity-based measure that you've seen in an incentive plan, whether it works or not.
Mm. Well, I think we lived through this, Virginia, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, when we saw this big push to put a lot of ESG measures in the incentive compensation plan. And to be transparent, I think some are fit for purpose. Like if you are talking about a foods company that needs clean water, like I understand how important that is into their incentive design. But we saw a lot of people overreact and put things in like, do we have LEED certified buildings? Do we have governance provisions in place? And I would say those are things that are par for the course and part of running the business. So we have seen over time organizations put those activity-based measures in the program to say, I want a reward for this. But I think the question that the committee needs to ask is that part of your job, or is that something we're incentivizing? And it's worth shareholders paying the incremental dollar for outperformance on those measures. I think the other challenge that we have with some of these things, Virginia, and this is a bit of a principle that I think we always like to say is we can set targets, but what does underperformance and what does outperformance mean on some of those measures? And I think when you start to get activity-based, you struggle with that underlying concept is what does good look like and what does bad look like?
Yeah, and what's the scale of performance you're measuring, right?
And you really, I mean, in any kind of performance measurement, you want to focus on outcomes as opposed to activities. It's easier to list the activities. So it's a little bit of a lazy kind of process just to simply work out the activities. But you need to try to translate those into outcomes. Even then, there's still a question of, is it appropriate to have that in an incentive arrangement? Because everything that you're trying to measure an executive by, let's pick the CEO, for example, there's some things you do want to measure and you know, reward performance or be, you know, have performance management around for a CEO that doesn't need to be in the incentive plan. It should be part of the assessment. It should be part of the annual assessment the board has for the CEO, but doesn't necessarily mean that it should be in the incentive
plan.
I think here's a fair question for a committee member to ask. I think it's reasonable for you to say, I want to grow revenue. Right? Or I want to improve my margin. I think the fair question to ask is, okay, well, then how are you going to do that? And that's where activities have a role in the discussion. But I think you have to start with the underlying area of focus, which is what are we trying to aim? What are we trying to accomplish? And how do you plan to get there? How do you plan to differentiate our product relative to our peers? Those are where I think it's important in the committee room to have activity-based discussions. But I would submit they may not necessarily be needed in an incentive plan design.
So where I see them often is in if you have either a modifier or a carve out for individual performance, and particularly around the staff jobs, because I do think it is difficult to determine what, you know, a head of HR or a CFO or a, you know, top legal, what their roles and responsibilities are that do drive either change or success or, you know, completion of objectives without getting more activities driven. And I think that's the challenge companies have when they introduce individual performance at the executive level. What should we be measuring? You know, what should those goals look like, and how can we help companies veer away from more activities based, you know, attending a conference or going to a training class? Because I think we'd all agree those aren't true drivers of value creation. So what do you guys think about that?
I agree. I mean, that's where it's probably more appropriate. Some of those functional leads, even there, though, I think you have to push and say, you know, it's not the activity. It's not, we're going to implement an engagement survey this year if I'm the head of HR. It's mm-hmm. where would we're going to move engagement, and how are we going to move the needle? And so we're going to measure that. So it's the outcome. It's things like that. It's, you know, if it's head of IT, it's not just people are going to be, you know, creating AI agents, and we, you know, but it's like, what are we going to accomplish with those AI agents, and what is the outcome we're looking for? So if you can translate that into an outcome, it starts to feel more appropriate. But again, you have to use it in moderation.
You know, one of the things that I think has just changed over time in the committee room, and this is, I'm interested if this is your experience as well, is we've sort of, there's a compensation component of it, but then there's the human capital component of it. And some of this initial conversation, I think, is a question of when we're talking about those successes related to the human capital initiatives, are we talking about leading indicators or are we talking about lagging indicators? And I think this is maybe part of the root of the question of, I think initially when we first started to expand the remit, we were really talking about lagging indicators. Like, did you have an engagement survey? What was your voluntary turnover? I jokingly said in the committee, or I wasn't joking, I said in the committee meeting the other day, someone was touting their voluntary turnover over the last couple of months. And I said, well, voluntary turnover is at an all-time low sort of across the board. But the question is, can we incorporate some of those leading indicators into some of the design and some of those discussions? So if the focus is efficiency, like, well, how quickly as a functional leader are you responding to your revenue generating needs? Like, how quickly is the legal function moving? How quickly is the HR function doing some of its transformations? Those are some of the things that I think are important parts of the discussion, and maybe ultimately a component to the functional, the way in which we compensate the functional roles. But that's probably one of the dialogues that I would say there's an opportunity to evolve the way we're thinking about the human capital side of things.
So why do you think companies don't go that direction? Because I agree with you. I think, and frankly, for a lot of different metrics, I think leading indicators would be much preferred over lagging. But to me, it's about, you know, what can you measure? What's definable?
I think, Virginia, all that's changing. Like, I think the rationale for it historically was, these are hard to identify, and there's not enough data to support some of these things. I think just the way in which we process information today and the speed in which we do it and the barriers to create those measures and create those systems has just, like, the barriers just lowered over time. So I think we'll increasingly see more of it. But when those dashboards first came out, it was largely, well, I'm able to track turnover because I have the capabilities to do it. I think now you can talk about other sort of HR measures that tend to be more leading. So, you know, in other succession management, like, how many of our officers are taking leadership development courses? Those are sort of things that I think will evolve over time just because we're spending more time and energy and there's more of a conversation around it.
Well, and just not to go down a rabbit trail, but a side note, I've, because of the lower voluntary turnover, I've had more and more committees just in the last couple of months ask the question, is voluntary turnover too low? Yeah. And do we need to be really kind of, you know, being selective and doing some selective terminations
to try to improve talent?
So separate topic, but it's coming.
But good question.
That question, I had to jump up in 10 years, and now I have multiple committees asking, like, should we be, you know, pushing some people out that aren't performing well?
Well, and it's about individual differentiation, which I think oftentimes we find at the executive ranks, many companies don't incorporate that into their overall program designs because I think the thinking is everybody at this level should be performing or they should be, you know, shown the door. But I do think there are companies that do this well and that have incorporated that into program design and that are willing to, you know, to to differentiate across the team, which can be difficult, especially with the disclosure rules the way they are today.
Well, and there's going to have to be some trust in the management team, because the committee is going to have to rely on the management team to come back and report on some of that stuff. So there's going to have to be a fair amount of trust that they're, you know, giving good, accurate, fair assessments of some of those things, because the committee is just not going to have the you know, the insights that they have with like financial measures, obviously.
So let's shift directions just a little bit. So there's plenty of companies that have kind of that delayed outcome where success might be 5, 7, 10 years down the road. You know, pharmaceuticals come to mind. How do you think about incentive plan design for those types of organizations where it's not just a 1 year or a 3 year, it's really more like a 10-year time horizon?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, pharmaceuticals, that is one area where I've done some work, and, you know, there are some sometimes at more activity-based. In fact, it's one of the few areas where I've seen activity-based metrics even in long-term incentives around regulatory approvals for new drugs. And so, but even there, we've pushed to make sure that we're not just measuring approvals, but we're measuring the right approvals that are driving towards, you know, profitability and drugs that they can use. So even there, it's really pushing hard to make sure that we're, you know, selecting the right measures that is driving value.
And then how do you measure that? Is it a longer term time
horizon? Well, again, any of those things, there has to be there has to be a fair amount of trust in the management team, because you have to be able to rely on the team to be able to come back and accurately assess those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. In the case of pharmaceuticals, you may have, you know, a science committee that is diving into that in more detail. So, you know, that's a unique area where you might have a separate board committee that's also, so in that case, the science committee is reviewing the approvals and then reporting back to the comp committee before the comp committee approves any incentive payouts. But yeah, there's a process, and there's a level of trust that has to happen.
I think about this maybe slightly differently, and maybe it's the lens which I advise, where my clients, yes, you know, I do a lot of work in financial services where actually people are the investment that we're making. So whether it's hiring bankers or traders or, you know, recruiting whole teams over to companies and recognizing that there is a significant investment that we are making to get that individual over, and we have to manage but not compete and all these other things that might, I'll say, slow the top line growth. But I really like to share with those committees is, let's look at things when we're making those investments, let's look at things over like a time series. And let's not just look at things in 1 year and 3 year periods. Let's recognize the investment that we're making and understand, like, is that investment realizing over time? This is no different than an ROI analysis that a private equity firm does or a private credit firm does. But look at it almost through like a payout ratio lens and say, we recognize at some point in time, our ratio is going to increase because of just the inverse relationship of the math. But over time, that should normalize and shareholders should begin to, I'll say, realize the returns on the investment that they made. I imagine that's what happens when a pharmaceutical company or a CFO makes the case to make that investment in an acquisition or a drug or a team of people. And I think it's fair for the compensation committee to say, like, have those investments been realized over time? But it requires a bit of a longer term lens than just looking at things over a 1 and a 3 year period. Or Virginia, you wind up paying for it twice.
Yeah.
Like, you give them the exemption up front and then you wind up paying for it on the return. And that's where I think, to Ryan's point, there is a bit of a trust, but you have to do the work and do the analysis to make sure that you're getting a return on those investments.
Yeah. I mean, this seems to me like this could be ripe for a situation, given the potential loosening of some of the, you know, quote unquote, rules around performance-based pay, where stock options or some sort of really long-term restricted stock award could come into play. Because ultimately, if you're making those right choices over time, it should be realized in your price. But again, back to our 10-year conversation, yep. Will most executives out there today actually realize that value or not?
Yep.
So it's interesting. So maybe just to follow up on this continuum, what about organizations, and I have many clients that fall into this category, that struggle to even set 1 year goals, right? So we've been talking over time about, you know, 3 years tends to be kind of the commonplace, and that's, you know, where most organizations have landed. I have lots of companies that say we don't even know in the next 12 months what this thing's going to look like. So how do we help them think through that, or what things should companies?
Can we use a word like what was the word that malarkey or nonsense, right? Like,
you can use it.
Yeah,
we may not.
You can use it. Yeah, I don't. We do. I think everyone hears it, like how challenging it is to set these goals or put these stakes in the ground.
Yeah.
This is where I think a strong chair, a strong lead director, a strong head of the audit committee, and the intersection between audit and comp is important. To be able to say, if we're setting that budget, like what is the practicality or the realities of that budget that we're setting? But to say that we're not going to do it, I think that would be a governance letdown in some of the committee's responsibility. And this is where I think there's a responsibility. You know, Virginia, we used to have a scenario where it was good enough if someone was on the audit committee and the comp committee, or someone was on the risk committee and the comp committee, they considered that sufficient overlap. I think those committees working in combination with each other is like emerging best practice, if it's not already best practice, to make sure that when you're setting that budget in the finance committee, that's being clearly articulated to the committee chair, and you're thinking about the principles at which you've established the incentive plan design and the goal setting within the design itself.
And to build off of that, then, that there's really clear communication between the management team, probably the CEO and CFO, and the comp committee around the rigor of the targets themselves. Because I've seen cases where there's poor communication. The management team views the targets as stretch or even significant stretch, but that the committee doesn't really understand that. They don't understand that this is a stretch goal. And you really need to understand the probability around the target to be able to set the curve right. Because to me, that curve discussion is very important. What's, you know, how are we going to reward overperformance, and how quickly are we going to penalize you for underperformance? And you can do a lot of kind of strategic adjustments of that curve, or even flattening portions of the curve, but you have to understand the probability of the target itself. And then, of course, all of the macroeconomic uncertainties build even more, you know, volatility into that. But you got to really have a good communication there.
The one thing. I think this is important, and all that work needs to get done for sure. I ask, when we're in this goal setting discussion, I ask the question of the committee chair. I was like, what would make you jump up and down?
Like, what performance?
What performance would everybody in the room,
would you be willing to pay max?
Would everybody in the room just say, home run?
Right.
And what level of performance would you say, unacceptable?
Right.
Like, we have a problem.
Where would you be embarrassed?
Right. We have a problem.
Where would you be embarrassed?
Yeah. And that's a qualitative overlay to some. And where I think some of the tension exists is, look, these are extremely ambitious, most high-performing people in the world. They put their mind to something and they come. So we're in the room with the most successful people in the world, and they think, I can do it. So some of it's bringing some of the qualitative overlay and the reality of some of those things. Like, I saw the other day, we were doing some goal setting work, and to pay out maximum, someone had to return like a 25% EPS CAGR over a 3-year period. The question that's answered, like, has that ever happened in
possible
the period of this
firm?
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and if that happened, like, are we paying enough? Like, in some way, shape, or form? Like, if you were able to deliver that, like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
So I think some of those qualitative questions, and then just even stress testing some of the results. And what might be the resulting impact to an organization's stock price? Because that's another issue that might come about. Like, if we do it, like, now do we have another issue, which is like, we haven't delivered enough value to our leadership team.
Right. So I find this to be something that most companies seem to struggle with. And I don't know if it's, a lack of communication or coordination with the FP&A function, if it's, lack of education, or kind of bringing everybody along on the journey of, where that rigor lies over time. But I continue to challenge my clients to do that sensitivity analyses and to try to figure out what is the low case, the mid case, and the high case scenario. Because I think that's a critical step to incentive plan design in general, and certainly to goal setting.
Well, and you can fall into a, I think a lot of companies fall into a rut. They just, we've always done 90-110. We put thresholds at 90% of target, maximums 110. It's what we do every year. The CFO brings back the curve, they present it, it gets approved. Nobody ever raises their hand and says, wait a second, does that still make sense? Particularly in this environment with what we're facing now. So it should be questioned every year, but particularly in, for most companies in the environment we're in right now, a hard look at that needs to occur.
Well, and market input is interesting, but I find many companies rely on it too much with those conversations, because 90-110 might be perfect for some company that has a more stable, you know, earnings trajectory. But for some organizations that are much more volatile, it's got to be wider, and it doesn't always have to be symmetrical.
Mm-hmm. I like to have a conversation just on, I'll say, goal setting principles. Like everything we do, we talk about just overarching compensation principles. But sometimes when we think about the subcomponents of it, I think principles could apply to that as well, too. And if you constantly like retest those principles, when we're going through that goal setting process, I think that's a helpful way to reach conclusions. Like, does the shape of this curve need to change? Oftentimes we're not changing the shape until something happens, right? We feel like we've overpaid, or we feel like we've underpaid, or there's something going on in the market. And I think there's probably a better ongoing process there, to make sure that's embedded in the cycle. But I do agree with your initial statement, Virginia, is I just think there needs to be the intersection between the comp committee and the finance committee. You know, those firms that do a really good job at this, I think those folks are working together side by side.
Yeah. And one of the things I'd be interested in your perspectives on is, you know, oftentimes, particularly if we get brought into a new relationship and we're getting to know the company and their kind of, you know, historical performance, when is the plan broken? What we often hear from management is the plan's broken because it hasn't paid out. So when is the plan broken?
That's a good indicator. It could be broken. If it's never paying out, testing those that historical payouts versus performance, obviously, looking at investor expectations, looking at peer performance and payouts, all of those things, I think, again, should be tested regularly.
I don't know. I'd want to learn more. Rather than, and I think that applies on both sides of the coin. Like, you could make a statement that says the plan's broken when it doesn't pay out, or it always pays out, right? Like, there's both sides of that continuum. But if I look at that relative to other measures, I would say, okay, no, it's not broken. Like, it is working.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you take the highest performing organizations in the world that pay their executives really well, like, I don't think the committee's there mind paying above target as long as you're still on, like, your stock price continues to appreciate, like, the alpha you're generating for your shareholders is above what the S&P is, or whatever that indice that you're tracking towards is. And I don't think those that continually pay out and continually outperform on the share price, I don't think those committees say this plan's broken. I think they would say, okay, great, right? But I think it's when that alpha starts to deteriorate and we have an issue because we're overpaying, but we're not generating that alpha. But on the other side, I think it's, well, it's not paying out, but we are generating that alpha. That's when I think there's an opportunity to say, like, is our plan broke, or does it need some fixing?
Well, and back to this whole concept of activities-based goals, where I see those coming into play is often when an organization isn't growing. So they're, you know, the growth prospects have slowed. They're in a more mature cycle. Maybe they're trying to give, you know, more money through dividends, so they don't have as much opportunity on the share price appreciation front. So where I see companies then moving towards a bit of a more diversified program is they want to continue to attract, they want to continue to retain talent, but yet they don't have those future, you know, moonshot opportunities out there. So they start weaving in more activities-based goals.
So follow up on the whole activity question. Do either of you think it's ever appropriate to have activity-based incentive goals for a CEO? Is there a scenario? You know, we talked about functional roles and other roles where it might be appropriate? Is it ever appropriate for a CEO?
I think it can be in small doses. I'm a big fan of everything in moderation. I think in a small weight, so it's more signaling the importance throughout the organization rather than really trying to drive his or her behavior in a different way. And, you know, maybe the ESG example is a good one. You know, take a rail company, greenhouse gas emissions reduction, right? That's not a financially focused goal. It's not an individual goal. It's more of an operational objective that everybody has to kind of buy into. That to me would be an example of something that I could see find its way all the way up to the CEO level.
What did we say at an earlier podcast? We don't deal in absolutes, right? So I do think we have been in situations where the board has said to a leadership team, break this up, right? Like the pieces are more valuable than the sum of the parts. We've been in situations where boards have said, go, you know, like we're not growing organically. Go get someone or go do a deal. I think those strategic initiatives maybe require at some point to say, here are things I need you to do, go do them.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that there needs to be appropriate guardrails and when we're doing those things, but those are things that have already been communicated externally and, you know, you're willing to put those stakes in the ground. That I would say to you, Ryan, yes. Like, okay, let's examine that.
Yeah.
In normal course, I would find it difficult to say, like, is there a scenario where I would want to include that as part of the CEO's goals, largely because, like, the CEO, he or she should be strategic. Like, he or she shouldn't necessarily be, you know, I'll say moving the deck chairs on the deck. Like, they should be doing things that are creating value and helping the organization with, well, what do we need to do to accomplish goal X, Y, Z?
Yeah.
Well, and even with individual performance, you know, there's plenty of companies, I think it's like over half of the S&P 500 companies that have some form of individual performance in their plans. At the CEO level, those individual goals I often see as financial goals.
Yeah.
Right. It's more about, you know, driving earnings and, you know, maybe it's cost cutting or maybe it's, you know, top line growth. But the CEO's goals get quantitative and financially focused really quickly, even though they're, you know, quote unquote, his or her personal objectives.
And the question I've heard many committee members ask when it's been proposed that a CEO has activity-based goals, mm-hmm. the response often is, isn't that your job?
Mm.
Like,
right.
Are you just describing your job? Which I think is a very valid question. Like you said, Darren, there's some unique circumstances where you really need to drive the individual to go do something. But I think it's a pretty rare circumstance.
But I think strategic goals, and that's what, you know, I think of less about activities based and more about, you know, strategic initiatives that must be accomplished. And this gets to that whole, if we achieve X, Y, and Z over the next 12 months, that will set us up for future success 3 to 5 years down the road. I mean, data centers is a good example. I have a client that is desperately trying to put in place and get up and running a large data center, which for them, their distribution company, it will be hugely beneficial over the long term. It's going to require capital investment. It's going to require people investment. It's going to require all hands on deck kind of taking ownership of this process. And so they've put it into their goals all the way up to the CEO level. And it's a unique, it's a kind of divergent strategy for what they've been used to. But I think it's helping get everybody focused on this one really important objective.
Yep.
So. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works directly with boards and compensation committees to support disciplined, defensible pay decisions grounded in strong governance. Visit meridiancp.com to learn more. When companies are reviewing their own incentive plan design, certainly one input to that process is market perspective, right? One of many factors, by the way. Meridian puts out a study each year, the Corporate Governance and Incentive Plan Design study, which takes hundreds of companies' plan designs. It reviews the proxy disclosure. It talks about different prevalence and trends that we're seeing in the marketplace. And this is a great source of information for clients to use as a starting point for this discussion. But what I'm most interested in understanding from you guys is, is it okay to deviate from typical market practice?
Well, first, I'll just say, what a great resource, right? And this is clearly available for public consumption, but I use it in my daily work, Ryan. I'm sure you do too, Virginia. So is it okay?
Yeah.
I'll say to you, there are some things that we have all agreed. And when I say we, I mean advisors, issuers, shareholders that have just said, look, we don't like this. And there are things where you shouldn't deviate. So top of mind, gross ups for change of control provisions. I think there has just been complete consensus in the market that this is a bad practice. And the government has done things to get people to stop doing these. And I think the market has just agreed we're going to go away from this practice. There are probably a list of 20 of those things, Virginia. I don't know the right number, where I think the market has just said no more. Absent that list, I would go back to the organization. Well, what are we trying to accomplish? And what do we want to do? Let's use the market data to inform that process and understand why firms do what they do. And then how does that translate to what we're doing today? So I think that gives you a license to, that gives you a creative license. But I wouldn't want to do that without at least understanding, you know, what are our peers doing, or what is the industry doing, and why?
Yep. I agree. I mean, prevalence is important. Market practice is important. Should inform the process, should not direct the process. Even some of those third rail items that you mentioned, like the gross up, I think there are rare cases where I have made arguments that it's the right thing to do for shareholders, not just for executives. So you have to have the courage to step outside of market practice, and some things take more courage than others. All that being said, though, everything should always be grounded in what's happening in the marketplace. What can we learn from it? It shouldn't direct us, but we should understand it, and we might be able to learn something from it.
No, I was going to say, one of the things we hear a lot when we're first engaged is that people want something innovative, and you know, prevalence squashes innovation at certain times. I think sometimes we're over reliant on like a specific peer group and not willing to learn from what others are doing. So what are high performing companies doing, or what's happening in the technology space? That takes courage too, to step out and say, well, that's an interesting idea. What could it apply to me in those circumstances? So I think it's a valuable tool, certainly to think about those things, but you have to understand why you're using it and you know, how you want to apply this data on a go-forward basis.
I think it's a great point. And I have a few clients that do have these aspirational peer groups. They're nothing like them. They may not even be in the right industry, but they want to look at them, particularly for design practices, because it's a view to, what do I want to be when I grow up and how do I get there, right? So I think it can be a really valuable tool. And the same thing goes for just general marketplace trends, right? Where my industry may be different, or my company may be headed in a different direction, but I think informing that judgment with a broader set of facts is helpful exercise. Yeah.
Do you have any clients, Ryan, that look at like sort of like an aspirational peer group, or a peer group outside of their industry?
Particularly clients that are in transformation. I have a few clients. I mean, one example, company that was in kind of old line, more industrial business. They've been around for 100 years. But they're transitioning into a very technology-focused business. A lot of what they're building is the infrastructure that's behind some of the AI build-outs. And so but they still have some of these old-line businesses. So you've got this hybrid group of peers, but then there's also some aspirational tech peers. You have to be careful, because oftentimes those aspirational peers are better suited for some of the design questions, like incentive design, may not be as well suited for pay, you know, determining appropriate pay levels for all the positions, although there could be a mix there. But yeah, I think there's definitely cases where having an aspirational or a separate peer group can make sense.
So we've talked a little bit about disclosure implications and how that sometimes drives decisions, which, you know, maybe it should or shouldn't. How do you think companies think about plan design, and do the disclosure rules influence the choices they make?
tail wag the dog,
right,
is what you're asking.
Yeah.
Yes and no, right? I know that's not a great answer. I do think there, for the most part, I would say no. I think most companies I work with make decisions and then they say, okay, now we have to think about how we're going to, how we're going to convey these messages to shareholders. And I think that's the right way to go about it. There are certain circumstances, I would say, where we are doing more unique things, where as we're going on that journey, we want to make sure the messaging syncs with some other things. So I do think often sometimes we're thinking about those things side by side versus, I'm going to say the order flow that I described before, but those are the more unique circumstances. So I don't, I've yet to have someone say, I'm not doing that because I think it's the right thing, but I don't want to tell the world what I did. I think the view is, if I think it's the right thing, I'll find the right way to make sure I convey that message to my shareholders. And maybe I need to do a little bit more work on that, on our journey of including that in our filings.
Yeah, the tail should definitely not wag the dog. That being said, if the prospect of disclosing something gives you heartburn, you probably need to step back and make sure it's the right decision, or make sure you can explain it appropriately. And sometimes it is the right decision, but understanding how you justify it and really building that case is just a good process in and of itself.
Yeah. Next time, we move from what gets measured to what gets reinforced. Because even a technically sound plan can drive the wrong culture if it rewards the wrong behaviors. In the next episode, we explore a deeper question. What behaviors is your pay program actually teaching executives to repeat? Remember, good governance is not about having the most complex plan, but one that is understood by management and shareholders. Until next time.